是中国。
That's why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany.
Good morning. Today we meet Markus Wagner, professor of law and the director of the School of Law at the University of Wollongong Transnational Law and Policy Center. We want to discuss a special feature of China's relation to Australia and the rest of the world, namely what we call economic coercion. And we do this against the background of a lesson for us in Germany and in Europe, but also for the global trade relations. Let me briefly introduce Markus. Markus is an internationally recognized scholar in international economic law and governance, international peace and security, as well as in US and Australian constitutional law. What is particularly interesting for us is his project on weaponized trade, where he is working on trade measures that are not originally directed at protecting certain industry, but have political meanings. And this is related to his work on second and third generation barriers to trade. If I'm correctly informed, you worked on every continent. He has a professorship in Witwatersrand, held one in Bogota. He was in Heidelberg, Hamburg, and he was in Miami. He also taught in Chongqing. For the last 6 years, you have been in New South Wales at the University of Wollongong. We met in a conference in Australia last November and recognized that we have a lot of common interests in international trade and international political economy. So thank you for joining us today. It will be a pleasure. Our topic today is economic coercion as practiced by the Chinese government. China used trade policy to discipline Australia after Australia has criticized China's information policy in the context of COVID. That was 5 years ago. Since then, this policy has caught our attention. Can we see a direct link between trade measures taken in spring 2020 from the Chinese government to these Australian criticisms, Markus?
So I think the answer is yes. So if you look at what sort of happened in a variety of different areas, it's not just COVID, right? So there was a buildup, if you will, of a variety of criticisms that the then government in Australia under Prime Minister Morrison had. And even before that, so COVID origin was one. There was the treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. There was criticisms of the Hong Kong security laws. There was a whole range of topics from sort of criticism geared towards the Chinese side. There was criticism from the Chinese side, treating China as a non-market economy and anti-dumping investigations, for example. So that technically meant that cost and prices actually charged in China weren't used, but rather sort of a comparator, and that almost always in these anti-dumping investigations means that the dumping margin is higher. And so that combined with a fairly, shall we say, the Germans would say vorauseilender Gehorsam, right? Like the idea of anticipatory obedience, if you will, in terms of how Australia and how much Australia criticized the lack of an investigation into the COVID origin by the Chinese government. And the Australian government was very forthright. And at the same time, what might be useful to know is that for Australia, both for with respect to imports and exports, China was the biggest trading partner by far, right? So on the economic side, you had China as one of the biggest partners. And on a political sort of viewpoint, Australia by and large follows a sort of quote-unquote Western model, very much aligned with the US and the UK, European Union, a bit obviously a bit less so because of historical contingencies, if you will. But the context in which a number of boycotts that I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment against Australian products were all of a sudden put in place.
Is this in line with what the Chinese call the 14 concerns about Australia? I think that's also a list of concerns I have seen. Is this?
Yes, sir.
The result?
This is very much sort of these 14 grievances, as they were called. And I'm not going to go through all of the 14, but some of them, I think, were legitimately sort of grievances that one can air, right? And again, it's much more about the style and the substance and my own criticism. So I arrived in Australia not long before this, or actually after this was announced. And one of them was the blocking of Chinese investment or usage of Chinese companies, Huawei and ZTE, from the 5G network. And the one thing as a lawyer, when I had to write about this for the first time after coming here, was where is this laid down in Australian law? And I couldn't find anything. So I turned to one of my colleagues. Turns out that this was done by press release. So there was no official government act. There was no regulation. There was no law passed. And the Chinese government in various committees within the WTO started to complain about the exact same thing that normally Western countries complain about Chinese secret laws. So that criticism, I think, at least in terms of process, is valid. We can talk about the substance, but in terms of process, I think is very much valid. But then the other grievances are blocking of Chinese investment proposals, generally in agriculture and animal husbandry, in sometimes on basis of national security grounds, the criticism towards China that I mentioned already in Xinjiang, Hong Kong, South China Sea, Taiwan, obviously, and then a lot of negativity geared towards China that the Chinese government ascribed to the government, whether it was media, whether it was reports by think tanks and so forth. All of these were packaged in the so-called 14 grievances that the Chinese embassy in Canberra gave to a news network.
If I understand it correctly, the trade measures China took against Australian wine, Australian lobster, were not really official. They were more measures to, say, block entry because of health concerns, etc. So there was not an official measure taken and it was not legally, fixed. Can we say that this is the general thrust of the Chinese response to this sort of criticism?
Before we get there, just to make sure, we get a slightly sort of more encompassing picture. Some of these anti-dumping investigations were objected to by the Chinese, right, that the Australians ran. And some of them are potentially objectionable. So there was a little bit of a tit for tat, if you will, on a fairly low level. Now, to come to your question, I think if you go through each and every single one of the measures, and I'm sorry, I'm being lawyerly here, and I'm not going to do it bit by bit, right? But if you go through, say, barley, there was an actual anti-dumping investigation held, right? So that was, if you will, transparent. If you go forward towards beef, I think that's on much less safe territory, but there was communications happening between the Chinese and the Australian governments. I think that, so it's sort of a bit of my area in the SPS space. What the Chinese did by basically blocking imports from particular abattoirs was probably not based on actual scientific evidence, which would have been required, but was sort of one of those shots across the bow. Coal exports, just experienced, and this is very much in line with what you said, Andreas, these very severe delays in customs procedures that basically meant there were 50 ships parked essentially off the coast of various ports in China. And of course, the costs keep running up for the traders that want to deliver that coal. And there was never any official pronunciation to this effect. It basically, certain coal users were told, please don't use Australian coal any longer, right? So this is one of those intransparent ones. Wine was a dumping investigation. Lobster was, again, one of those SPS measures, but no one really knew what the problem was. And there was no cadmium ever found in Australian lobsters, right? There was a whole range of other ones. And I'll just maybe plug our own project that you mentioned already, thankfully, the weaponized trade project we have under the URL economiccoercion.com. All of those and almost 100 more case studies that everyone can look at, right? And we detail every single one of these weaponized trade measures and sort of give the context and say what those measures actually consisted of. So intransparent, I think by and large, yes. Some of them, no. But always geared towards having some kind of effect on the Australian body politic. And I think that's sort of where we sees the contribution of the weaponized trade measures coming to the fore, that there was a political goal trying to be reached that had nothing to do with the quality of the product or the actual dumping of these products into the Chinese market.
That leads us directly to my next two questions, so to speak. First is, do you see different behavior by the Chinese government or official bodies depending on the importance of the good for the Chinese market. I would think that wine is less important for China than coal. There's a lot of outside competition for wine. You can easily replace an Australian wine with one from our region, for instance. A second question about the effectiveness, because I think they are both related. How effective is that? Does it really harm Australia, or has Australia outside options? That's the second question. First is the importance of China. Second, the importance for Australia.
I think they're related questions, but let me try to tease them out a little bit. I think, and I'm the lawyer here and not the economist, but I'm reading enough economic literature that I think I can give you a good answer. I think the answer depends on whether it's a substitutable product in some way, shape, or form. So if we're talking about commodities, right, there it depends. With respect to coal, you can probably get it somewhere else, depending on whether it's coking coal or a metallurgic coal. The latter, much more difficult to source from places apart from Australia and wasn't hit. But there was a distinction made between products that China couldn't live without. And there's a reason, for example, that iron ore was never targeted. That, I think, became sort of one of those issues. And the trade measures, or the weaponized trade measures that we sort of identify, were sort of spread apart both geographically and among the industries, if you will. And at least from our analysis, with an attempt to put as much pressure and exert as much pressure on the Australian government as possible in order to sort of tone down the rhetoric, if you will, or take away all these criticisms that we just laid out with those 14 grievances. Your second question is, what have been the effects of that coercion policy? Did it harm Australia? And again, I'm mindful that I'm, while international economic, but still only a lawyer, right? But I think the answer is it did, but it depended, like I said, on the products that we're talking about. Lobster, while important for these, for very small communities, is largely an insignificant industry. Wine, not so much. And you add to that for both wine and lobster, the Chinese consumer is willing to pay a lot more for that product than almost any other market in the world. And so that, I think, created a real problem for those producers in Australia, because even if they were diversifying, and some of these diversifications were tried to be made, and we can go into that a little bit if you want, say to India or to other parts of Southeast Asia, they're just not nearly as high in demand, or the consumers are not willing to pay as much on a per quantity basis, right? So wine and lobster continue to struggle to this day. Others, I think, have basically either been able to diversify, or the Chinese market is starting to absorb these products again. Now, if you look into some of the literature, for example, Ferguson, Waldron, and Lim, they basically looked at demand shocks, right? And this is in line with what we would call weaponized trade. We're just shocking the demand. And now you can't export that product any longer into the Chinese market. And so some markets, bulk energy, mineral, agricultural products, don't exhibit these network asymmetries, if you go into that article, and therefore are less amenable to coercive economic statecraft. Some other products are much less significant or that are widely demanded, if you will, right? Commodities again. The impact was far less significant because you can just go somewhere else and the world market is still the world market and it's sort of, and the price adjusts. And in some instances, there weren't simply good enough substitutes for the Australian supply. So the argument that Ferguson, Waldron, and Lim make, and I think that's correct, but again, I'm only a lawyer, that weaponizing trade may work best if it's done by a coalition of countries rather than unilaterally. China's inherently bad at this, so as an additional argument. And we've seen, as of late, new records of trade between Australia and China, largely due to the iron ore prices, also lithium. But, and I say this again with a bit of a caveat, there are other voices that say Australia suffered greatly from not only the initial weaponized trade measures, but beyond. And I'll leave it to you, the economists, to tell me which one of these economists and political scientists are actually correct, because they're disagreeing over data. And it's usually the lawyers who are being accused that we don't use data, but it looks like sometimes economists can't agree on what the data actually means. I'm sorry, I have to throw that barb in every...
No, you are absolutely right. There's the saying, three economists, four opinions.
The same one goes for lawyers, right? It's no different.
But it's absolutely in line with what a reasonable economic argument would be. It depends on the price elasticity of supply and demand. And we have a lot of literature on sanctions, which you probably also know, which is really telling us that sanctions often are not succeeding. Let us move a bit towards the general lessons we can draw from this experience. First, speak about the global consequences. We have an obvious disrespect of international rules, which is displayed in such behavior. We would not normally accept, use protectionist tools, administrative tools to harm your opponents. So the whole world trading order is under threat. And we see, by the way, the same coercive tactics displayed in Canadian responses to Donald Trump's announcements. They say, okay, if you do this, we immediately target your constituencies, whiskey, jeans, and motorbikes. The same story. So what does it mean in the long run for the world trading order? Can we be still optimistic that the WTO remains? Do we move into bilateral deals and the general acceptance of weaponized trade, to put it in your words?
Okay, let's try to layer this off, right, a little bit. Number one, this isn't entirely new, right? So we can go well before this. If you recall the whole question around hormone beef and so forth, there were responses and they were targeting the European Union at some point. European communities at the time was given permission, if you will, by the WTO to put countermeasures in place. And those were then targeted at steel from Ohio and oranges from Florida. And this was all in the context of the 2000 elections with George W. Bush. And these things are not unusual, right? So you try to influence. I think what we're seeing today, though, is slightly different. And we struggle quite a bit when we developed the project of weaponized trade, which was, interestingly enough, financed by the Defense Department here in Australia, not by Foreign Affairs and International Trade. I think there's a qualitative difference of what we're seeing today. Number one, we don't have what I call the kumbaya moment of international relations after the fall of the Berlin Wall, right? It didn't last long in the grand scheme of things. I put sort of the beginning, obviously, with 1989, 1990, and the end point, to me at least, is 2003, the invasion of Iraq by the U.S., in which the U.S. starts to lose a whole lot of credibility in the eyes of not only observers, but governments and generally people around the world. I think that's sort of the beginning of the, not downfall, but sort of the a start of a negative tendency for the U.S. And at the same time, you have China ascending with its accession to the WTO in 2001. I personally don't want to give up on that vision yet. I'm a child of the 1970s and the 1980s in Europe, and I think integration as such is not a bad thing. It doesn't always work, but it oftentimes has. But what we're looking at the moment is we're seeing a significant departure from the traditional trading order at this time and running with the risk of siloing of international trade. And this is not just me saying this, but rather if you look into the 2023 report by the WTO, then you see this being mapped out economically, right? So this is Ralph Osser and his team at the WTO that looks at a fragmentation of the global trading system into distinct blocks, sometimes driven by security concerns in the real world, ideological differences, pursuit of strategic advantage. That brings with it not only economic, but also political consequences. We did a whole range of interviews for the weaponized trade project, and one expert identified a future Five Eyes arrangement, for example, in which trade is increasingly restricted to trusted partners. Right. So this siloing. Now, within those blocks, and this goes back to the WTO modeling that I found fairly instructive, I must say, in the World Trade Report 2023, within those blocks, there's clearly benefits. This is something that we see with the European Union. This is sort of a classic question of trade diversion in more integrated blocks. But this fragmentation likely leads, obviously, globally speaking, to reduced efficiencies, higher costs, limited access to diverse markets, and so forth. And one of our experts, again, another expert said, well, this is sort of the classic balkanization of international trade, bifurcation of trade and investment flows. And then we very quickly land in the pre-World War II era where trade was inherently strategic and often intertwined with geopolitical rivalries. To me, that's a real risk. And this goes beyond sort of hard legal analysis, but I think we all need to step outside of our realm and make clear to people that this siloing is inherently dangerous. It carries risks with it. It carries certain benefits potentially, but also carries risks. And I think what we're going to see in the near future, I only need to sort of look 3 days in advance. We're recording this on the 17th of January, 2025. So I'm talking about the Trump inauguration, obviously. Sort of the announcements that Trump makes, I think, would exacerbate those risks, where we would, on the contrary, what we would need is sort of a contrary move to mollify some of these risks. But I think we're not at that moment at this time.
Well, that's my perspective as well. I was always a big fan of Cordell Hull and the trade creates peace hypothesis. But I think it's not as strong as the opposite hypothesis that autarky creates conflict.
Funnily enough, if you go into that trade report, there are correlations exactly along the lines of what you just mentioned, right? So you can map this out. And I'm a strong believer in this. I always say this. So I grew up next to Strasbourg in France. So the classic sort of German-French sort of war fields, if you will, right? And in the very small town that I grew up in of like 11,000 people, there's a Swedish soldier on a fountain, because the Swedes ransacked the town 3 or 4 times and burned it down and so forth. But if you look at the last 1,000 years, and this is what I don't know, but I think it's true. If you look at the last 1,000 years, after the creation of the European, what now is the European Union, this must be the longest period of peace in that space.
So this is the big topic about international trade, I think, is this peace creating power. But it's not a given. You can have trade and still be not peaceful. But the opposite, I think, if you are not peaceful, you won't trade at all. And then poverty is growing, etc. So we are in a very risky time at the moment. You are right. Mm-hmm. Let's take the last view before we stop is on say, what can Germany learn from the experience Australia has? One is their dependence on Chinese, on the exports to China, but the other is also our sourcing strategy for commodities and for, say, important inputs. If I understand correctly, the German business community is lamenting that part of the rare earth are either from China or from places which are owned by Chinese companies, so that we have almost 100% dependence on China. I never saw them speaking about the potential diversification. So what would you think? What would be a strategy for Germany, say, to escape that threat of a weaponized export or import strategy in China?
So I'm going to try to tease this out a little bit, because I think there's, for Germany and all other EU countries, I think there's a sort of multi-level governance question that they need to answer for themselves. And I think we're seeing sort of some ruptures potentially. The first thing I would say is that rare earths are despite their name, not rare. They're just hard to dig out, right? And the question is, number one, can you find the resources in the ground, if you will? That's actually not particularly difficult. Even in a place like Germany, there's rare earths. The question then is the refinement strategy. And there, I think China has, while not a monopoly, I think the rest of the world lacks China considerably, or is far behind China, partially because it's environmental degradation, or at least it's quite costly not to have environmental degradation. So there was at one point a WTO case around rare earths in which all of this played out. But now let me come to your question with respect to Germany. But before I get there, I think we need to go to Europe, because I would like to start at the European level and then layer that downwards, if you will, to the German side. I think if you look at, for example, European corporates, European countries individually and the EU as a whole, they started to realize that there was a risk. There was great benefit to be reaped in the 1970s and 80s, a little bit like the Wandel durch Hand idea we know from the Ostpolitik in Germany. So this idea that you create change through economic integration. But I think that the risks, the downsides were realized far too late, right? And so we get all the way to 2019, where we have a renewed approach by the EU, very much sort of a strategic framework that identifies China as a partner, a competitor, and a systemic rival. Heavily criticized, obviously, by the Chinese in that respect. But I think, at least on the European Union level, after 2019, you start to see that naivete going down quite a bit and being at least a little more strategic. And I think the European Union was very late to the party. People might differ on this, but I always thought that integrating Turkey into the European Union would have been a great strategic asset at a very early stage, and because it would have opened up Central Asia and other parts of the world much more so. But that was a failure to not integrate Turkey, and I think we're seeing that play out now. Now, if you go then specifically to Germany, I think the realization is finally dawning that this old adage of Wandel durch Handel probably is not going to work at all times. I think it works under certain circumstances, but it doesn't work at all times. And I don't think, and the reason why I've wanted to preface with the European Union, I don't think Germany, even a Germany, isn't large enough to effectuate change, if that's even possible within China, or defend itself in this new geopolitical and geoeconomic world we live in. Right? So you need to have that European leverage, which, by the way, was incredibly useful for Lithuania when basically all of its products were kicked out from the Chinese databases in one fell swoop, and no one from Lithuania could export into China anymore just because Lithuania didn't exist, right, within the databases. Now, the German government's position towards China, I think, very much reflects this tripartite approach, partner, competitor, systemic rival that the European Union has put forth. The strategy on China, I think mid-2023, acknowledges this. And I suspect that most EU countries, with maybe the exception of, shall we say, Hungary, probably put forth the same position. And so German companies are now, for example, coming to Australia. But what I'm observing also is that almost every European Chamber of Commerce is running its own show rather than having one overarching policy, right? And to what extent German companies are jumping onto that bandwagon, I think, is questionable. I think the German government has started to realize that, for example, the sale of MAN Energy Solutions, part of Volkswagen, to a Chinese state-owned company in July 2024 was going to be banned and was banned, citing national security concerns. Then this whole question of industrial and technological policies, cybersecurity concerns, I think they're all coming much more to the fore. And that initial naivete, as I would say, call it, is giving way to a much more serious concern that both companies, the corporate sector, and the government needs to play catch up. And unfortunately, play catch up, because I think the strategic discussions in Germany have been lacking for at least a decade, if not more.
Yes, I think we always thought that trade is totally separate from politics. And thanks to your project and thanks to other insights, this has changed. Thank you very much, Markus. That was very insightful. And I think our listeners will have a lot of food for thought now. We might get back to you and we will definitely look at your website. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany, sponsored by the German Federal Ministry of Research, Technology and Space.